these violent delights and violent ends.
Welcome to Violent Delights, a Westworld podcast. We are your hosts, Andrew Sorcini,
Dwayne D,
and Tosin Enofawakin.
We just watched the sixth episode of Westworld's second season titled Phase Space. We assume you have as well, so total spoilers ahead. Let's dive into the after talk, but before we do, we've got some online spots you can get in contact with us. You can write to us or email us a voice memo at hbowestworldpodcast@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter at hbowestworldpod or just hashtag Violent Delights. Our Facebook page is Westworld Podcast. Add us on iTunes. And if you do that, please like us and leave us a review. That's how we get noticed for the show. First of all, a little disclaimer here. Tosin, you are out of town. You're in Massachusetts and not in your normal home.
Would you be in Massachusetts?
Yeah, I was back for a college reunion. And I am missing my sort of large 4K TV experience of Westworld and to a much smaller set, but I'm here nonetheless.
And that's why you sound a little different and a little muted. So we apologize in advance for the way you sound, but you'll be back at home for next week's record.
I just want to step into that college. It's not worth going back. Just kidding.
All right, so let's talk about Phase Space. This episode was written by Carly Rae and directed by Tariq Saleh, who is a fairly novice Swedish director. He's only got like maybe five or six things on his IMDb to his credit, and I think this is the first episode of TV that he's directed, from what I can tell. So a good opening episode for this guy to direct. We don't normally, anyone who's listened to Violent Delights know that we are not normally a recap show. We really sort of dive into analysis. But before we get into the analysis, we'd like to do just a brief little recap to catch people up. So, Dwayne, I'm going to toss it to you. Can you give us a little recap of Phase Space?
Sure thing. And the reason why we do this is just to make sure we're all on the same page before we break it down. All right. So we start with Arnold and Loris in the lab. He's frightened of Dolores because he doesn't know what would become of her if she outgrows them or that place. Arnold confesses that he must make a belabored choice between the unknown and an end. We discover that this is sort of a dream or something. He says, I'm not sure what choice to make. And then we learn that Loris is being used to test the fidelity of Bernard, just like how William tested the fidelity of old Mandelos two episodes ago in the Riddle of the Sphinx, which kind of turns, once again, second season, everything's turning on its head. Mm-hmm. Okay, so in Shogun World, we see the aftermath of Maeve's handiwork. Maeve herself seemed to have been in the battle between the Shogun's forces and other forces. Akane pulls the heart from Sakura, and the group returns to the village where Akane's pleasure house was to find Musashi and Maeve's captured team. Musashi and the Shogun's captain Tanaka engage in a duel, which ends in seppuku for Tanaka. Maeve's little band makes their way towards Snow Lake, where Akane puts Sakura to rest. She and Musashi stay in Shogun World, while Maeve takes her team through the Westworld's bowels to the homesteading sector of Westworld. Maeve leads her team to retrieve her daughter. She finds the little girl, and she sees that she's being reassigned to become the daughter of another host who looks a lot like Maeve, or at least who's styled a lot like Maeve. Mm-hmm. The Ghost Nation attacks, and Sizemore uses the opportunity to call for help while Felix leaves his fellow humans to aid Maeve. Back in Westworld, the man in black believes his daughter, Grace, is a host. She proves him wrong by exposing some rogues and then calling him out for not drinking in the real world. We learn that she had written him off and the family business of Delos, but that when he learns she came to bring him home away from the park, he agrees to leave with her, but then it turns out he was lying and he abandons her. Mm-hmm. Over in the Mesa, Stubbs and Hale have Abernathy. It's revealed that Stubbs has been in the dark about the park he's been to secure. Hale reveals the ruthlessness of Delos and the focus on Abernathy, and now they can get some help. As they wait for Delos' help to arrive, Abernathy is bolted to a bed with a sort of nail gun. Delos sends Coughlin, a man who's an armed Delos agent, who arrives by parachute, and they begin to use their advanced tactics to gain control over the Mesa and its systems just before Dolores attacks. In contemporary Sweetwater, Dolores sits in the brothel playing the piano. Teddy walks in. It's revealed that she's attempted to awaken him through the text. Teddy kills a man at the train terminal because his answers aren't forthcoming enough for him. And Dolores is somewhat shocked at who she's made Teddy become. Dolores and Teddy use the train as a battering ram to break into the Mesa. And then finally, we have Elsie and Bedard. They find their way back to the Mesa earlier in the show. She finds that while QA is trying to fix what Ford's broken, the Cradle has been rebuffing those fixes. Bernard and Elsie go to the Cradle, where Bernard accesses the system directly by allowing it to pick up his brain, basically, and put it inside. He spends time in a virtual Westworld that's intact. And as he walks into the brothel, he sees Ford playing the piano. And that's the end of the episode.
Yeah, yeah, that's some pretty heavy duty stuff. It ended on like a real sort of like kapow moment there.
Dun, dun, dun.
Yeah. Let's get into the salient points about this episode. Let's just jump right into it. So first of all, let's start off with phase space, which is the title of this episode. I had to look this up because I had no idea what phase space means. And
you didn't? Ugh.
No. Oh, ugh. You.
Clearly, you didn't go to Amber's College.
Right? Yeah, right. Like I ain't book learned like you guys.
You learned on the streets.
Yeah. There is no phase space on the streets, man. So phase space, the definition that I found is a multidimensional space in which each axis corresponds to one of the coordinates required to specify the state of a physical system. In classical mechanics, the phase space is the space of all possible states of a physical system. I read that. I still have no idea what that means. Maybe you guys.
This is why I said what I said when you started talking, because it's like, if you're going to use it as a technical term,
yeah,
it has no bearing on anything useful at all, right? But I feel like Tosin, you found something about this, right?
Yeah, so I mean, there are a few interesting ways of looking at it. One is sort of from a technical perspective, in which you provided the definition of like, it's essentially like all possibilities within a particular system. So one of the things I was thinking about is like, it's all interpretations or permutations that you could see of a specific story or world at the time. But I also found that there is a collection of science fiction stories, a 2003 collection by British writer Stephen Baxter, that's called Phase Space. And it has 23 thematic linked stories in which human relationship with the universe is explored. And, you know, it delves a bit into, you know, if humanity is truly alone in the universe and sort of other intelligent species exist. And part of that seems a bit interesting when considering the world or world that we're looking at here of Westworld, where we have hosts and humans, and we're looking at part of their relationship to the world. We're looking at how the themes of life, death, and the cyclical nature represent and are, and, you know, exist for, you know, regardless of if you're human or not, and what is intelligence. So it could also be referring to that.
I also feel like there are a couple other things that are interesting. In terms of phase, space shows you all the different permutations.
Yeah.
In Shogun World, we saw different permutations of Maeve's crew, right?
Oh, yeah.
And then, so that's kind of cool. And then when we get to the Cradle and Bernard goes into the Cradle, you know, what we find before he goes in is that the Cradle holds the live minds of all of the hosts, or like a backup of it. So there are going to be many different permutations of the same characters in there. So he walks in. The first thing he sees is another version of Ford. And it's another version of Westworld altogether. Meanwhile, with Maeve, we see another version of Maeve as Mother, right? And last week, even though it's not in this episode, we saw another version of Clementine. So, but that the reason why I bring up last week is because this week we're in the same brothel that has that separate version of Clementine. So I feel like there's some of that when it comes to this idea of phase space.
Yeah, and one last point about the collection of fictional collection. There's also a point that I read in terms of whether or not these these other species are intelligent, or if they've turned their backs on us, and if expansion itself is destined to fail. So that's from the Wikipedia interpretation of that story. So kind of interesting when you look at that perspective too, when we see the quest of Dolores and potentially that of Maeve too.
Yeah, she's definitely trying to expand Dolores.
Yeah.
Lots of potential interpretations there, so we're seeing. So and it's probably the kind of thing that will become clearer as we get towards the end of the episode, or the end of the season, just as the bicameral mind in season one became clearer as we got to the end of the of that season. Tosin, why don't you give us another salient point that you discovered about this episode?
Yeah, so speaking of Dolores, one of the things that that's further highlighted in this episode is Dolores as a leader wants unwavering fidelity, and she really wants a team that will obey her every instruction, no matter what. And so we you know, learn that at some point she had control over Bernard and was potentially reprogramming him as one example of that.
Yeah. You know, this is one of those things where, before you move on, Tosin, this is one of the things that I thought was one of the most fascinating bits about this episode. You know,
especially because they started off with it. They were like, hey, yeah, check this out. Okay, bye.
Yeah, like this episode and last episode both had these opening scenes that I felt were really sort of little data dumps of information that are fundamentally might change everything that we know about this season. So in this episode where we see Dolores and whom we think is Arnold, in that sort of remote analysis lab, she at one point she freezes him, and we realize that this Arnold is really apparently a host, and she's testing him for fidelity, as you mentioned, Duane, the same way that William tested James Delos for fidelity a couple episodes ago. And it's we don't know if this is if this Arnold is a host or a beta version of Bernard. We're not or if this even exists in the physical world, or if this exists in the cradle somewhere. We don't know at this point.
But yeah, that actually struck me as really interesting, because it kind of felt like a dream. And for so many times we deal with Dolores, you've got this dream thing going on, right? Like she's waking up from a dream. And so now that we know the cradle is this virtual space, why build all these versions of James of Bernard, right? If you're forward and you realize that the thing isn't going to work with these multiple versions of a robot, then you can do it virtually. I mean, Tosin, you work in this space, right? Like, virtualize things where you can. So that was also an interesting thing for me to see. I did love the fact that you have a host telling what seemed not to be a host, but actually is a host, to freeze all motor functions. That was mind-boggling. Yeah.
As we continue under that unwavering fidelity, we mentioned Bernard. We've got to mention Teddy, of course. Teddy had a pretty good quote in this episode where he said, "The man who rode that train was built weak and born to fail. You fixed him." So we can see that, you know, Dolores generally has this sort of perception of it's like either my team or the highway. And by the highway, we mean death, right? Where it's like there's few individuals she'll try and sort of fix and maybe convert over, Teddy being one, maybe Bernard, hard to say. But if not, she will wipe them out and continue on her way. She has one sort of core mission. While we have Maeve, on the other hand, and what we learned, you know, from last episode and was expanded a little bit in this episode, is Maeve can control individual actions and just control their minds, right? So she's not necessarily, she to a certain extent, you know, as we started this episode, she didn't really give people will or free will, right? Dolores gave the perception of free will, but if it wasn't to her liking, she would manipulate it and change it. While Maeve was, you know, the quote-unquote witch behind the scenes.
Yeah, that's a pretty good layout. I think it's super powerful, considering how Maeve ends up telling people about their own fate, which I know we'll get into later. But yeah, Dolores sort of like says, yeah, you be who you want to be. And then the minute Teddy's like, hey, you guys get to go, she's like, oh, fuck that. let's fix Teddy.
Yeah, and I think you're quite correct there, where, you know, Maeve does have this realization and this understanding where she says we deserve to choose our fate, even if that fate is death, in response to Akane. Yes.
Yeah. Fidelity, it's a thing.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems to be a running sort of through line in this season. What is truth? What is fidelity? Tosin, why don't you give us another one of these salient points?
So another salient point that I found, or something that was fairly interesting, is, you know, as we kind of look at the phase space interpretation and kind of think of Maeve's role in this kind of world,
mm-hmm.
Well, you know, continuing that through line in which she talks about being able to have choice and being able to choose your own fate, it kind of makes sense that Maeve is set into this sort of historical Japanese world, because she understands honor, she understands tradition, unlike Dolores, who you can imagine putting her in this world and kind of running amok and completely changing it to be something that she wants it to be. Maeve lets it run with its own sort of purpose and through line. And we noticed that, you know, during the fight where one of the samurai commits seppuku.
Right.
Musashi's about to kill Tanaka, and Tanaka decides he's going to die with the ritual suicide.
And so, you know, she lets that happen. She lets that pursuit, even though that could very easily have changed the direction of her storyline and sort of the individuals who she would be able to leave with, if at all.
It was his decision to make. She let him make his decision.
Yes, exactly.
And she didn't interfere by making Tanaka kill himself. Because like you said, she does have the ability to change physical actions. In fact, she had two of Tanaka's men kill themselves when she walked up. What's really weird to me is that she still isn't able to do it with the Ghost Nation, right? Like, something about the Ghost Nation, she either forgets to try or whatever, but for all her control, she doesn't use it on the Ghost Nation when they show up at the end of the episode.
Maybe she's too sort of stressed out by the fact that they're chasing her, you know. It's like she can't do it under duress, perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, maybe you're right. Or she's just afraid of their faces, or, you know, something.
Could be. But it's kind of crazy. She was definitely triggered by seeing Ghost Nation, of those old memories of Ghost Nation attacking the homestead. Just a minor little point here. Another point that I notice is when Elsie logs into her system when she and Bernard get to the Mesa, she says they got climate control working. Nice priorities. And I thought that was, I recognize that as a nice nod to the 1973 movie where when the park malfunctioned, the techs who were running the park died by suffocation in the control room. They died because they couldn't get air going through. So I thought that was sort of a nice little inside joke there.
Yeah, I like that a lot. I thought it was pretty clever, especially because, like, before we started, like, you know, watching the season, we all took a look at Westworld again, and it seemed so random that they stopped breathing. So the fact that she has nice priorities, it was pretty tight. Yeah. I mean, Elsie's one of my favorite characters.
Yeah, that was a great catch. I did not notice that at all in this viewing, but yeah. Great.
Another thing that I thought was pretty cool was the screen and keyboard, the floating display and the screen keyboard that she was using. It was a nice visual touch. We get to see a lot of tablets in the show.
Yeah.
And so the idea of looking at an actual workstation as opposed to sort of like what you do on the go to mess with a droid, a host, was pretty cool. Added a bit more depth, a little over similitude. I like that. In reality, though, last year I was at CES and I had to use a glass keyboard that had no feedback.
Uh-huh.
It is impossible. Like, I'm sure you can get to learn it eventually.
Yeah.
But without being able to slide your finger between keys, it's a bit of a mess. Like, you need travel.
Well maybe these Surface keyboards that she's using have some sort of haptic feedback.
something. It was, yeah. I mean, I love watching characters glide through interfaces in movies, and it kind of, you know, yeah. I almost wish she'd reached out and she did some swiping like Minority Report, but at the end of the day.
Or Avengers,
right? I dug it. At the same time, yeah, those glass keyboards, man. Yeah. Speaking of creating things, Tosin, the Man in Black?
Yeah, so one thing that's sort of been kind of in the back of my mind throughout this episode was we know that like William's progression in Westworld created who this the Man in Black was, right? And that and William always saw Westworld as sort of a very sort of distinct world. They even mentioned in this episode a world without consequences, where he was able to separate the two characters, right? The Man in Black existed in Westworld and had its own sort of goals, pursuits, as Grace mentioned, drinking in Westworld and not drinking in the real world.
Mm-hmm.
But I think where William sort of erred is that he thought those things were completely separate. However, it seems to me that the individuals within his life were able to kind of recognize the duality of character that he represents outside of the world, where, you know, the Men in Black is not just a separate portion that you can partition away, but that blackness bleeds into the other parts of your life and is really who you are. I think Logan pretty astutely called it out near some of the last episodes of season one. But we hear about this, like, ruining the relationship with his wife. James Delos calls this out as well, too. And, you know, when he says without consequence, well, it looks like there actually are real world consequences, especially in the relationship of the characters you have. Westworld on its own does not exist in a vacuum. And so even, you know, now that I think about it, when we look at, when we also look at the definition of this episode as phase space, well, Westworld is a phase space in the greater universe too. So kind of interesting when you examine it from that perspective.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Just another permutation.
I thought it was interesting that the people that know the Man in Black the best are not buying his bullshit. They see through that duality, and they see through the facade of putting on airs of being the nice guy when you really see that he's got that duality of nature.
On some level, though, I mean, the whole point of Westworld is so that you could be who you need to be in the real world, knowing that when you get out to the Westworld, you can release and be yourself. Like, granted, whatever aspect of his non-public character was present when he was at home with his brother-in-law and his wife and his daughter corrupted, you know, those relationships. But on some level, it shows how the promise of Westworld doesn't always work. And I thought that was pretty interesting because, you know, when we saw season one, we saw some people saying, oh, you're, you know, William, whatever. Wow. I've been following your charity work and whatever. And he's like, oh, fuck this, you know. So it's clear that he needs to get his groove on, so to speak, and just release and displace whatever frustrations he has in this space. But I think, as we'll talk a little later,
mm-hmm.
He doesn't really want a Westworld without consequences, so that's interesting.
So Dwayne, what did you think about the Hale and Stubbs chemistry?
Yeah, kind of like pivoting away from heavy relationships to these light ones. There was some pretty good banter there. Hale says to Stubbs, good luck on your next review, by the way, which was hilarious. Because, like, you know, Stubbs is supposed to be security. He disappears for, like, half of the last season.
Yeah.
You know, the park is falling apart. We haven't seen anything about who's going to pay the consequences of this disaster. And if you just take your mind and kind of project it out to what happens when bad things happen at corporations,
yeah.
You know, they blame somebody, they point the finger. And it seems like Stubbs his role was designed to be the scapegoat for this kind of thing.
No, shit. This season it was in this season. We've seen it from the beginning, from episode one. When Carl Strand came off the boat, he pretty much dogged on Stubbs as well for the shit show that
is Westworld.
That is Westworld, the post-gala massacre. Yeah.
Right. And then now we learn that Stubbs wasn't even made privy to so many things.
Yeah.
So that he was set up to fail. So that was pretty interesting. So one of the funny things I saw.
He he's kind of, you know, an unintentional, to a certain extent, idiot. Like, he was much smarter in the very beginning of Westworld, where he's like, I don't trust these guys. I'm drawing my gun out.
Right.
And as we go down, you know, to see what's happening in the basement. But now he's just kind of there. You know, he's in scenes, but he's, so far he hasn't really made any decisions of consequence. He's like, yeah, he's just like along for the ride.
Maybe he'll redeem himself by the end of the season, or by the end of the series. Maybe he'll take out Hale once and for all. Who knows?
I see him saving Coughlin's life and gaining some Coughlin respect. If this goes in the way of any normal TV show, there's going to be a moment where either he saved Coughlin's life or he's alive and Coughlin isn't. So there's that.
So Dwayne, you saw some Christian imagery in this episode. What is that?
Right. So Abernathy bolted to the bed, right?
Yeah.
So, clear this bed away, whatever. You know, this dude is like, yeah, we've got this huge gun.
Yeah.
Stubbs is like, is that necessary? He's like, oh, don't worry about it. It's fine. and it's kind of like, and I just kind of felt like Pontius Pilate being like, it's time to crucify this guy. So earlier in the season with Craddock, we had the Last Supper. Now we have Abernathy in a scene not unlike Jesus on the cross.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why I thought it was interesting is because Abernathy he's salvation, right? Like for Hale and so many others in Westworld, Abernathy's capture represents salvation. Just like Pontius Pilate crucifying Christ represented those guys being saved from Rome's wrath. Rome being the superpower that was outside of Nazareth. And so here we have Abernathy, who is sacrificial, and he's being pinned down in order for, you know, Stubbs, especially Hale and all those other people to survive, right? So I thought that was pretty clever.
So another salient point that I have here is that Maeve comes out of a fight, right? We see her pretty early holding swords. But usually she's just instructing others to kill, and she's sort of standing to the back a little bit.
Yeah.
More kind of similar to like what Dolores was at first, and then Dolores like grabbed some guns and just started getting into the fight as well. We finally see that from Maeve. However, we don't necessarily see that in front of the camera. We were supposed to perceive that behind the camera. So it'll be interesting to see if that actually changes at all.
Yeah, it's implied that Maeve was in that Super Samurai battle, right? Where she got the skills, we don't really know. We know that she's kind of pumped up all her stats, so like fighting dexterity should be pretty high.
Mm-hmm.
But she's standing there with the sword. She's got blood on her face. Her kimono is covered with like blood. And while Akane is kind of like hovering over Sakura's body, and you know, before she rips her heart out, she's kind of like in this kind of like samurai protector thing. And it would have been pretty sweet to see Danny Newton, you know, using a glaive or the katana or whatever to take out some baddies while protecting Akane. But I guess we didn't get to see it. I guess it was kind of perceived off screen.
Yeah, but by the way, I'm not sure if it was just me, but I'm actually quite glad that they kept them all sort of bloodied throughout this episode rather than, you know, how they, in most shows, they clean things up, right? People would take a quick shower and then continue on their pursuits or change their clothing. That was a nice touch there.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty clear that these hosts, hygiene is not of any kind of import to them.
As you mentioned in last episode.
Yeah, I mean, they're disgusting. And they're looking up. And then Maeve and Akane is like walking around with blood on their faces. Like, I don't know. It's crazy. Speaking of Maeve's powers, you know, fighting, whatever.
Yeah.
She's got these mental powers we've been talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was pretty interesting how, you know, Maeve just had these two guys Takana was controlling kill themselves. Well, she had one guy kill another guy and then kill himself. And then Musashi is trying to convince Tanaka to get on a duel.
Yeah.
And Tanaka's like, I don't have time for you. And he goes, show your men I'm not a puppet. Show your men that you're not a puppet, right? Which is funny. Because at that moment, Maeve was trying to use her puppeteering skills against Tanaka,
yeah.
Right? So when you think about that, she's trying to move Tanaka as a puppet. He's like, show your man you're not a puppet. And it's almost as if that her hearing that helps her realize that all people must.
You got to choose your own fate.
Exactly. So she begins to hold back on using her new skills, which is hard because when you get a new skill, especially if it's a cool one, or a new toy, especially if it's a cool one, you want to use it. That to me was a pretty cool point.
Dwayne, you also had some interesting thoughts about this quote from Musashi. No man is safe who refuses to protect his own land. Cowardice is a tin shield.
Yeah, that struck me as like a very pretty line. It was quite poetic, but it wasn't convincing, right? Like this idea that like, hey, leaving would be cowardice or whatever. Now, I know that Shogun World is all about honor and brutality, and, you know, he's probably going to go down in a blaze of glory against whatever's left of the Shogun's men. But I think to myself of other great stories, like Aeneas runs away from Greece to start Rome. And I kind of felt like the reason why that felt thin, it felt thin to me, but then I was like, I'm okay with that because the Shogun World hosts are not awoken the way that Maeve is awoken, that Hector is awoken. And so they're going to be drawn to staying within Shogun World, right? Now, the only reason that Armistice's Japanese counterpart is leaving with Armistice is because she may not be awoken, but Armistice and Armistice's counterpart are kind of in love with one another. So you can see from a trueness of character, you know, why she's going to go with the rest of them. But I kind of felt that was kind of interesting the way the programming is going to find a way for them to rationalize staying, which is helpful for the show. You don't want too many characters and all that stuff, but it was
right.
It was pretty interesting to me. That was cool. Andy, any other interesting things to stick out to you before we head away from the salient points?
Yeah, you know, you had that imagery of the burning heart, Sakura's burning heart, and the blood on the pristine made-up face of the geishas.
It's also mentioned, yeah.
Made for some great imagery. And we also learned that the Raj has been around for quite a while, assuming that the Man in Black's daughter, who he has mentioned before as her name being Emily, but in the context of the show so far is listed in the credits as Grace. So we're going to still call her Grace, I guess. So that would make her about 30-ish if the Raj has been around for a while and she remembered going to see the elephants there as a kid.
Yeah, that makes sense, especially because if you think about when we saw the little girl with younger William in yesteryear, William is, you know, probably in his late 30s or 40s at that point, and then we see her, you know, William as the Man in Black, you know, his kid is not going to be some like 25-year-old, you know, that kind of thing. So it's it was interesting to see. But yeah, the Raj has been around for a while, which means Westworld, while it's the center of what we're seeing, isn't all of what Delos does. That's pretty interesting.
All right, let's move on to our unanswered questions. These are things about the episode that we still have some questions about. We're not entirely sure where we land on these things. There's some interesting things in amongst our unanswered questions this week. Tosin, I'm going to kick it off to you for the first one here.
Yeah, so the first question I had is, you know, after Teddy gives that sort of interesting line to her about like how she's changed him and tells her to forget about him, or at least forget about the old Teddy. You know, Dolores kind of gives sort of a pensive, questioning, or even a reflective look. Maybe it's even a look of regret. Did you guys think that she was kind of questioning this update that she made, or she might have any sort of regrets around this and may want to roll back Teddy later on?
I don't know if I felt it necessarily right there, but I definitely saw, I think that Evan Rachel Wood did a good job acting, or she always does, but when he took out that one tech, right, that guy who had been helping her manipulate the various hosts.
Yeah.
He's like, I don't know where he is exactly in the mace. It's a really big place. I don't know. Which is a cool foundational phrase from him, because the mesa has to be a really big place in order for them to walk in the bowels of that thing and get from Snow Lake and Shogun World to a homestead in Westworld, right? Maeve and her team. So he kind of establishes how big the place is before Teddy just shoots him indiscriminately. And on her face, she's like, what the fuck? You know, so it was really interesting to see how she did that. So I do think that she's surprised at the unintended consequences of her change of Teddy. But we'll see how that works out. Cause you know, she took away his self. She didn't feel like he was awoken enough. She's woken him up. And then we have to worry what happened. I think she has to worry what happens if Teddy outgrows her. What happens if Teddy wants to leave her behind? Not unlike what she was talking about with Arnold Bernard earlier.
I will say that I definitely saw a look of regret or remorse or
WTF, mate?
Yeah. Or your buyer's remorse on Dolores's face when towards the end of the episode when Teddy said when they're on the train and Teddy says, you know, I used to want to get out of this place, but I guess you changed that in me too. Then Dolores had a look on his face like, oh shit, maybe I dialed this thing too far. I might have gone
so intelligence a little too high.
Well, he's so woke. He's woke about the fact that she did this to him.
Yeah.
So whoever he is, she's responsible. I mean, he's dastardly. Teddy's going to rival the Man in Black now. And when it comes to, I mean, he gave that dude the one bullet in the gun and said, you know, you better use it quick. And then he like locked him, you know. It was just like, if I were that guy, I would have shot a window and jumped out and taken my chances with like a couple broken bones.
Good point. Good point.
But yeah, he was shit, Teddy.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
Well, it's kind of interesting because if you recall, like Teddy, although he's been like typically goody two shoes or always marching down a particular pillar, until you know she was like Wyatt in the past. When we look at his hat, Teddy's always been a black hat, right?
Yeah, he's always had a black hat. But I think that when it comes to the black hat, white hat thing, it's pretty much being cloistered around William or the guests more so than the host. I mean, I don't see a lot of, unless you want Westworld to be really comical, I don't see a lot of ranchers and stuff wearing white hats around.
Yeah, that's true.
Tosin, why don't you give us another unanswered question?
Well, this is a question that I just wasn't sure about, and I think Dwayne might have some insight here, is when we see Maeve's B team, the humans, trying to figure out the way to like the underground facility.
Yeah,
they're digging around a structure, and they kind of find this little tube that like shoots that they slide down into. And I was just kind of confused because every other secret structure we've seen, we've had normal elevators, right? Like, so what's going on there? Is this another way of cutting costs or something?
No, I think so. For me, two things stick out. One, Sizemore has established that Shogun World is far more brutal than Westworld, right? And so that kind of weird pyre thing where they put the bodies of the dead, it makes sense to have a chute so that those dead bodies can quickly get back to the underground technical people who basically serve the same purpose as Felix and Sylvester did in Westworld in Shogun World. So that's a place where you just slide the bodies down. Now, lucky for them, it's not like a place where you slide the body down and it kind of like sits in some pit with no oxygen for a while. It just kind of works, you know? So they slide them down, people fix them up and so on. That's why when they land in a whole bunch of other wrapped up bodies. So it looked like it was meant to be some sort of traditional place to put the dead. You wrap your dead and then you put them there and then whatever. But yeah, the little shoot was to get those bodies taken care of. So I don't know that they needed an elevator, but I get why it's definitely incongruous with what we've seen in Westworld so far.
Yeah. Yeah. I would agree with you, Dwayne. We've seen offsite on Delos destinations and Delos intranet websites. We've seen parts of the sort of the training manual, and one of the pages shows where they will take Tex will take the bodies and dump them in places like empty graves, which actually lead to like body shops where they can repair them. So,
which is where how Maven and her team, they go down to shoot a death shoot, right? Yeah. And they come up through an empty grave.
Yep.
So, that.
I've got some questions for this episode, and maybe in sort of in general, some really big questions here. So first of all, what is the intent of the Ghost Nation Warriors? Throughout this entire season, their motivations have been a little mystifying. Why have they been saving the humans? And in this episode, why do they try and take Maeve with them? They say, you know, we're on the same path. Come with us. We're on the same path. What is that path? And why are they saving the humans and not killing them?
Yeah, I thought this was interesting, especially because Grace is talking to the man in black, old man William.
Yeah.
And she notices that, you know, William's got his posse. And she's like, those aren't real Ghost Nation arrows, right?
Right.
And suddenly you realize there's some bandits who used Ghost Nation paraphernalia to make it look like there was some sort of hijacking.
It's a honeypot trap.
It's a honeypot trap, right. So part of it is by saying those aren't Ghost Nation arrows, that the Ghost Nation didn't kill those people, she's helping to establish the idea that the Ghost Nation isn't running around killing people, right? And that's really interesting. We saw the Ghost Nation kind of go after Maeve earlier before she ended up in Shogun World, right? Hector stopped her, tried to stop them for a while. She and Sizemore are running, and the Ghost Nation was after them then. And now they're re-pursuing her. So for whatever reason, they want Maeve, whether it's because she's crucial to what they have to do or because of some kindred purpose. But it is interesting to see how they're working. It's also, again, super interesting to see how she's unable or unwilling or unaware of the ability to control those particular hosts. So that was so interesting.
Another big question I have, the Red Chestnut, the second control unit that Bernard takes from the Protagoras lab, which is that remote lab that he was in with the drone hosts. Does that control unit contain the essence of Robert Ford? Is that how Ford's spirit happens to be in the cradle at the end of this episode? We don't really know. We still don't know for certain who is in that Red Chestnut, that second control unit. And we don't
even, if it's a who, it could be something that gave the whole cradle whatever ability to improvise that they're fighting with right now over in the
right. The, well, I think we gathered from his conversation with Elsie in when they were in that lab together that it is meant for another it was meant for another host, or it meant for another body or something. I can't remember exactly, but it is meant for another individual is what I gathered from it. So I don't know whether that individual is Robert Ford, if that's how he got into the cradle, or if that little red ball is still meant for somebody else.
Bernard also mentions that he'd been there before, that he put something in there before. Yes. And it makes sense that thing is the Red Chestnut, that control unit that you were just referring to. I mean, he made sure everybody died who was working on it, and then he took it for himself. He even had the drone hosts kill themselves, right?
Yeah.
So it was super secret, and if it was Ford, it makes sense. Now, why Ford would want to die and have a copy of himself live, I don't really know. But that kind of begs my idea of motivation. But what I will say is that it makes sense for Bernard, who's kind of always been chasing the truth, to confront Ford. And unfortunately for everybody, I have a feeling that Ford's not going to give us any straight answers next episode or the episode after that. Right. It was also interesting to see how Ford chose to have the reconstruction of himself in the cradle to be old Ford and not a younger Ford, right? We always think about when you go to heaven, which version of yourself do you want to be, right?
Yeah.
So that was pretty interesting.
Just as a extra textual point there, if you go to the Dallas Destinations site and you log on to their intranet, you know, the interface where you usually get to talk to Aiden, the host on Dallas Destinations, you can talk to now Robert Ford. And if you ask how he got into the cradle, he'll say, I think you know the answer to that, a simple solution that fit in the palm of Bernard's hand. So that sort of leads you to believe that his essence is inside that red chestnut. But again, that's extra textual that's not within the text of the episode. So, you know, your interpretation of that is up to you and not necessarily
canon. It's certainly a hint.
Yes.
If I've never seen it. What's really, it's you know, managing all this content.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Right. So, Andy, you had one more question in these big the big questions.
Yes.
The big picture. What was it?
Okay. So here it's the big question from the beginning of the episode. So we've seen this back and forth with Arnold and Dolores at the beginning of the episode, where Dolores stops him and says, you know, no, that's not what he said. And we see that Dolores is testing this person, whether it's Arnold or Bernard, for fidelity. So the question is, all of the scenes that we've seen with Arnold and Dolores in the remote lab from season one, were those actually now Dolores training the Bernard host to be like Arnold? Are those all, does that all like tie into what we're seeing in the beginning of this episode? Are we seeing Dolores actually training Arnold, the Arnold host?
I'd have to say no, and here's why.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, the reason why it makes sense for Dolores to test the fidelity of any kind of Arnold replicant, any kind of Arnold-based host, is because of the conversations and the intimacy that she had with Arnold in the past. We've seen those conversations, and I would take those conversations at their word, even though Westworld likes to play around with editing stuff, because in the first season, we were seeing how Dolores became Dolores, you know?
Yeah.
And having Arnold there, beginning, you know, going through the metaphor with Alice in Wonderland, beginning to do those discussions, it's part of the intimacy between Dolores and Arnold, just like there was intimacy between William and Old Man Delos. You need that intimacy in order to be the person to check the fidelity of the other person. And so on some level, the reason why I think it matters in season two that she does this in this episode is that she's trading on all those times she had with Bernard, with Arnold rather, to help Bernard understand who he needs to be.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I don't think that we can discount all the previous stuff as just some training exercise, especially because we see the lab where all that took place, and we. You know, that's where, you know, Bernard killed the director. Back when she and him were having some relationship, she killed him because Ford basically told her to.
May or may not be the same lab. That may
or may not. May not be the same lab. Yeah. But we've seen the lab where it seemed very much like that was the lab.
Sure.
Where Arnold and Dolores were talking. What really gets me is that Bernard was holding the chestnut. And we know in that lab, Ford was having a new host built.
So in my mind,
you know, that was kind of a thread left hanging in the wind.
Sure.
That new host that was being built. Hopefully that'll come back. Hopefully that'll do whatever. But I do think that the only reason why Dolores is appropriate to test the fidelity is because she's been in those conversations in that scenario with him before.
All right, let's get into our big picture section. This is where we talk about the aspects of this episode that tie into the season as a whole and to the series as a whole.
Right. So, Andy, you wanted to talk about the way the showrunners are using the predetermined arc to bring fidelity to Westworld's continuity, right?
Yeah. So in the past, in other interviews, at South by Southwest is one that comes to mind immediately. The showrunners, Jonathan Nolan and Lisa Joy, have mentioned in the past that they've laid out the series arc well in advance, so well in advance that they've been able to drop references to later episodes, and in fact the whole series arc, like well in advance. And up until recently, we've been fairly oblivious to them because we didn't know how the narrative was going to unfold. So, and halfway through season two, as we are now, I'm beginning to start to notice some of the clues from season one that they've dropped, that only they knew were coming. You know, we had no idea were coming. Like, for example, in one of the early episodes in season one, I can't remember what episode, Maeve is speaking to some Japanese tourists in Japanese, which establishes that she's got the comm skills to speak Japanese in last week's episode.
Yeah, I think it's cool. I mean, they're not the very first to do this, but at the same time, it's important. I think when we look at shows that have been likened to Westworld, like Lost, it was pretty clear for a lot of people that they didn't know where the show was going. And in fact, they made a statement, hey, we're ending it in season six. We've got a plan. And that's what kept people watching. So starting that way is great. I mean, this, if you've ever watched like Buffy the Vampire Slayer, this is how Joss Whedon did it. There are episodes where he mentions the exact count of days between that episode's airing and the episode, you know, four episodes later when another one's going to air or this situation will come up again. It's crazy. And you need to schedule like that. And it's nice to see that we're getting a mega movie, right? Just a big, big story instead of a week by week. Let's just keep people watching by doing crazy stuff. Story. We don't want that.
It's going to be nice when this is all said and done to go back and watch season one all over again and be able to point out all of those little details and see, oh, they did put them in there. They did put all this in there. It's all there right in front of us. There's another point that I'll bring up, but it's more of a theory at this point, but I have a feeling that it's going to become significant later on. Tosin, you wanted to talk about the broader meaning of the powerful quote from earlier in the episode, right?
Yeah, there was this great vocal overlay by Akane while Maeve was just looking out and viewing the battlefield. And the quote goes like this, breathing in and out, moving forward and back, living, dying, coming, going, like two arrows meeting in flight in the mist of nothingness. There is a road that leads to my true home. I'd love to hear a little bit about what you guys thought about this quote, but it kind of, for me, something that I tend to say a lot is home is where the heart is, and we
quite literally this,
home is where the heart is, Kali Ma. No, throughout this sort of episode, and even in the big picture, we know that the hosts are really trying to drive towards what they consider home, either inside this world or outside of it. And in this episode, we see that Akane takes her daughter's heart back to where she believes its home is. We know that for her, death is also seen as sort of a new home. And even, you know, Sizemore and William's daughter both want to, quote, get out of Dodge. So there's this sort of thread of, like, trying to find home, or maybe it's more like your happy place where you're sort of content filled, or you've sort of finalized your journey, whatever that may be. And to a certain extent, I actually believe that Ford and Arnold may have had different interpretations of home, right? Because we know that from Arnold's perspective, he was building his outside home very close to where Westworld was and was sort of thinking about what it really meant for Dolores as not just a host, but as a sort of person, as an identity. While Ford, on the other hand, at least in young Ford, it's hard to know the motivations of old Ford yet, because I think we'll still be figuring that out. But at least for young Ford, you know, driven towards more the financial investment, driven towards more, you know, the satisfaction in building a world and creating something as technology that other people can live in. Maybe that's kind of is where his heart was, to be honest.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, for Ford, Westworld was kind of home, right? So he had his office, he had his space. He didn't really leave anywhere. Mm-hmm. This is where he focused. Mm-hmm. He lived it. In fact, when he wore clothes, his clothes worked in the world of Westworld and in the future world that he lived in, right? So the idea that his home was Westworld is interesting. On top of that, if indeed the chestnut was Ford's a copy of Ford's mind, and he's now living inside the cradle. That's his home. He's finally made it home, right? On top of that, Maeve, you know, her quest has been to go home, to go back to the homesteading area, homesteading. And she gets home, and we all realize you can't go home again. She gets there, and she realizes she's been replaced with another host that is taking care of what she looks sees as her daughter, right? Obviously, Sizemore uses that whole entire engagement to try to get to his home. So, yeah, I see some of that. I think that's a pretty...
And Dolores wants to build a new home for herself.
Yeah, and she believes that she has to do some work in the outside world in order to do that. Meanwhile, Teddy was like, hey, why don't we just go try to make a home here? And she's like, dude, we can't do that. We gotta go out and solve the issues that are crowding out our world, and then maybe we can come home. So, yeah, it's a good motivation. It's simple, it's elegant, and it keeps the characters focused on what they want to do, which is why the side quest to Shogun World felt a little off until we see what it did to Maeve to change her character, and especially because we can finally see her, what happens when she does get home. That was kind of nice, right?
Yeah.
So it's time to talk about the piano, guys.
Mm-hmm.
It's been something we discuss during every episode in the more technical points of the episode, but I think it ties into the big picture this week, right? It's becoming something a bit more significant. And Andy, why don't you start us off?
Yeah, so the piano, I think the piano, and in particular the mechanical player piano, has been a huge thematic theme through the entire series. And it's interesting, in this particular episode, you had, if you remember back to season one, episode 10, just before when Ford is delivering his final speech before Dolores shoots him, he's essentially saying goodbye. But he says, Mozart, Beethoven, and Chopin never died. They simply became their music. And I found it really interesting that in this episode, as Bernard is walking into the Mariposa and he sees Ford's Greyhound walking into the Mariposa and sitting down at the piano, which is playing, you see Ford is the guy playing the piano. Ford has become the music inside of his artwork. He's become the ghost in his own machine. So it's very much, I feel, like a personification of that quote that he gave in season one, episode 10.
Yeah, I think it's and even just to piggyback on what you're saying, Mozart, Chopin, Beethoven, they became their music. What does that really mean? It means that their personalities, for whatever they were, are drowned out a little bit in this time after their deaths. But what stayed, what they're synonymous with, is their work, right? They are their work, right? I'm playing Beethoven. You don't say I'm playing a piece written by Beethoven.
Right.
So when we look at Ford, if indeed Ford is the chestnut and he's now inside the cradle, the cradle is doing this improvisational thing. The cradle is exerting its own sort of will against the people who are trying to QA Westworld. And if Ford is at the heart of that, Ford is pulling those strings, then we see Ford manifest becoming his work, right? The whole point of this is to get the IP out of Westworld. That's what the Delos guys are trying to do, get this intellectual property, the secret to the minds of these hosts outside of Westworld. And the cradle is where they would get that. And now they can't get that. Ford is protecting that work that he made, that he feels he's responsible for. He's become, in essence, the cradle of Westworld. He's become that. So that, to me, was also pretty interesting. The piano is also a key point of visual interest in Westworld, because we see it time and time again. Mm-hmm. What I like about the piano is that typically it's a player piano, right? Typically, it's a machine playing the piano, right? But then we see Dolores at the beginning of this episode playing the piano. Now, Dolores, for all her humanity, is still a machine.
Yep.
So it's still a machine playing the piano. But Dolores is playing it, and she's in control of the space. Then we see Ford playing the piano, and it's a virtual Ford. It's a version of Ford that's virtual in this construct. So he is. It's his mechanical piano. It's his mechanical. It's his virtual self playing the piano. And he's in the cradle. So if the cradle is in control of the Mesa, or at least the cradle is keeping control of the Mesa from Delos' QA, Ford, the incarnation that's virtual, is in control of the piano. Just like Dolores, who's in control of the whole train crew, who's playing the piano, and she's in control of like Sweetwater in that space. So as a control piece, as a setting, as a heart, it's it was really interesting to see how the piano was used to say who's in power here, who's got the power right now.
Right. Ford is quite figuratively playing everybody. He's playing the QA team. He's basically
Oh, I like that. He's literally playing.
He's like, literally playing them. Yeah, I'm playing you guys.
We've noticed throughout the episodes that Dolores and Maeve really have contrasting styles throughout the seasons, right? In terms of how they essentially manipulate people and how they go about trying to get to their home or, you know, whatever their quest is. And initially, Maeve's methodology did seem a bit tamer, more on the light side, but kind of in this episode, we finally recognize that both their roads lead to more depth and tragedy. Kind of like the quote that we mentioned above, you see a ton of death on Maeve's side now in terms of that battle and in terms of people whose lives were affected. So, you know, no matter which way you go, it always seems to lead down a dark road.
Death becomes them. Yeah, speaking of the battle, last week we also thought that they all had their own armies, right?
Yeah.
Maeve might get an army. You know, Dolores has her situation. William has his posse. Man in Black has his posse. We don't really see that sticking around this week. Pretty much all of the gains Maeve may have made in Shogun World are gone when it comes to, like, a large fighting force. So she doesn't. So what does she ultimately get out of the quest? She gets her powers. She doesn't really completely know how to use them, but she uses them in a pinch. We'll see what happens with the Ghost Nation in Maeve. You know, maybe they're the fighting force we've been looking for. So that was interesting. But really, guys, we got to talk about Will and Grace.
Will and Grace. Nice. Yeah,
I don't mean this TV show from the 90s that's come back, who's been resurrected like a host in Westworld. I mean William and his daughter, Grace. Just what's going on between them, what we've seen. I mean, we talked about it a little bit at the beginning of the show, but I think Grace did a very good job, the presentation of Grace did a very good job in building out a character that we thought we knew.
Sure. Yeah, we even thought we knew her name, and as we turned out, we still don't know who she is exactly. But I mean,
Emily Grace is a nice name, you know.
Yeah. Maybe that's it. Maybe it's Emily Grace.
And what's also interesting is that she's there, Grace is there, and despite this duality, she decides she wants to let him know that she doesn't blame him for their mother's death, and that she doesn't want him to commit suicide by a robot. Yeah. That she wants to take him home, right? And those were all big reveals, right? The idea that she's suddenly there and she's there to like take him home, reconstitute some family. It was surprising. But what I did think was also interesting was when he's like, you know, you never really liked this place, whatever. Grace says, "I've always seen the appeal of it. Life without consequences. It's what made it so fun when I was a kid. And that's why it's so sad you're still obsessed with it now." This idea of life without consequences that we talked about before, it was interesting for me to say that because the irony for me is that the Man in Black, as long as we've seen him, has always wanted the consequences of the actions in Westworld to be more real than they are. You know, he gets shot by somebody. It doesn't really hurt.
Yeah.
It hurts, but it doesn't really bleed him. And only once Westworld goes nuts does he seem to really be having the time of his life, right? When he goes for the maze in the first season, he's like, yes, finally, this is beginning to mean something. And now Ford's game, he's like, this is beginning to mean something. Although he gets a little upset when he thinks that his daughter is a host.
Yeah, see, I think that's where the Man in Black's daughter is wrong. He's not still obsessed with life without consequences. She doesn't see what his real... what his real motivation is. And we've seen that what he wants is for some reason or another, I'm not entirely sure exactly why yet, but he wants these hosts to be able
to hold up.
yeah. Like, but I'm not sure why exactly. I'm not sure what the purpose is. I still in the big picture, I still don't know what the Man in Black's motivation for wanting to change the game is.
I think on some level, he fell in love with Dolores, like properly in love, right? One of the first times where she has consensual sex with him on a train. And then when she's out there, she's playing the piano as she does, again, a robot playing a piano. And he's drawn to her during that party, that kind of retirement party for old Mandela's. And old Mandela's kind of steps in and sort of reminds him that, look, you got a wife, you got a kid.
Yeah.
You know? So he's been in love with this robot and she hasn't been awoken. So as much as he loves her, it's unrequited because she wasn't real. Now she's kind of Pinocchio style, like a real girl. Yeah. So there's that. But he's kind of too old to take part in that. And he's done so much harm to her that he can't. He's a spoiler for that, too. So I can see why he wants the hosts to become more real. But I don't know that he sees himself being a part of whatever life they live. But it was also interesting to me because, you know, Grace says she's there to bring her father home.
Yeah.
But in that same conversation, she said she was trying to avoid Westworld altogether, right? There's this very convoluted kind of thing that happens in the conversation where Grace is like, I was trying to avoid this place. And he's like, but you're here. I am here. Let's go home, right? I love you. I missed you. And it kind of felt to me a little thin, right? Westworld has done a very good job of introducing new characters, giving them purpose. But the whole I'm in Raj world, a tiger attacks me, yeah. I end up washed up in Westworld, I managed to catch my dad, I now want my dad to come home, that's why I was here the whole time.
Yeah.
It all seems to me like a little bit contrived.
Yeah, I don't know that I buy that either, particularly since when we first saw her in the Raj, she's got this notebook with a map that has the logo of the Delos research group on it. So I think there may be something else involved too.
I really hope so. I really hope that there's something about how she, you know, she's trying to find information or whatever about this place. She talks about Hale and how she doesn't like her.
Yeah.
Remember, we thought Hale was her daughter in the very beginning. I mean,
right,
at least I did.
Right.
His daughter. But so that's interesting to me. I do think that what you just said, how she's wrong about her father, that did add a nice bit of depth. It, all too often in TV shows, movies, books, people say things that are like, oh, I know you. This is what I know about you, right? Imagine any kind of Shonda Rhimes thing where someone has like a big monologue. This idea that she's saying this and she believes it, but it's fundamentally untrue based on what we know, feels more real. Fathers and daughters, parents and children, they don't often really know the motivations of the other, even though they know them and care about them. So that to me felt pretty real.
All right, let's get into the technical aspects, music, acting, special effects, etc. Stuff that commenting on the actual making of the episode itself. Usually this is where we talk about stuff like music, like Ramin Djawadi's cool interpretations of
90s music.
Of modern bits of music. This episode we had just Ford playing the piano at the end of the episode. I'm not sure what that piece of music was. It's a classical piece, it sounded like. If you guys know and you can tell us what that is, or if it has any sort of thematic significance, I'd love to hear it from you guys. So otherwise, I don't know. A couple other things. We saw when Maeve sees her daughter acknowledging the new mom, the new homesteader mom, as her mother. My heart just about broke, man. And I,
you knew it was going to happen, though.
I knew it was going to. That's one of those things.
Sitting there by yourself waiting for me.
Yes. I knew it was going to happen. It was still heartbreaking to watch it. And I think a lot of that is sure due to Tandy Newton's performance.
They did some great work there, too, with the makeup. So in Shogun World, she's kind of all put together. Right?
Yeah.
That's the style of Shogun World. When she gets out and she's looking for her daughter, she's running to her house, there's this kind of like weathered look on her face. Like you can see the lines in her forehead. You can see these other things. And then when they show you the new mom, right, the new host that's taking care of that little girl, she's a very fresh-faced version of what Tandy Newton's character used to be, right? So when you see old scenes of Tandy Newton with the daughter and everything, she's fresh-faced. She's kind of almost younger. And here we see this fresh-faced, kind of super innocent-looking woman smiling, oh, who are you? That kind of thing. So I love the kind of the weatheredness of Tandy Newton because of her journey.
Yeah.
And then seeing the little girl again. But you were saying? Sorry to interrupt.
Yeah, so in a way, also, it reminds me a lot of the scene from last week's episode where Zombie Clem looks at New Clem and is sort of mouthing out the words. She's going through the same motions. And I think it plays into this sort of thematic thing we touched upon earlier where you can't go back home again, man. You can't return to your roots because everything has changed. Everything is different. There are new people doing those roles that you were in before.
So, yeah, I mean, the world moves on even if you're not there.
Yeah. And last, a little bit of a technical aspect I wanted to point out is the scenes that were inside the cradle simulation when Bernard walks into the simulated Sweetwater, those were all shot in Letterbox, and so were the Dolores Arnold interrogation scene at the very beginning of this episode.
No!
Yeah.
Wow. I didn't pick up on the Letterbox of the interrogation scene at the beginning. It did feel like a dream. And if the cradles where dreams take place, I don't know. What really got me, though, about the whole cradle thing was how Bernard couldn't just kind of Johnny Mnemonic jack into it. He had to have his skull opened up and his brain taken out and installed in the cradle. Like, what kind of system is that? That's some serious security.
It's interesting also that before his skull got, like, scissored open, he says, pain is just a program. And thematically, we've seen last season where he is always talking about pain is the only thing left that I've got to remember my son by, the pain. And we've touched upon this theme also before of pain being the one thing that sort of makes us human, that connects us to reality.
Right. Especially because these hosts are now willing to endure pain for their end. So like Dolores gets shot 2 times and keeps on walking because the software is not telling her to go down.
Yeah.
And now he's like, yeah, I just cut my bald head open. Just do that and get my brain out and have me hang out for an hour and then bring me back. And Elsie's like, I can't even turn off your pain. He's like, yeah, don't worry about it. So on the one hand, him saying pain is just a program.
Yeah. Yes,
he understands he's a computer. But by being willing to endure that pain, there's a certain humanity in that, right?
Yeah,
it's gonna cost me pain in order to get in here and see what's going on with the cradle.
I've got some really interesting fan theory stuff about the cradle, so stick around for that. But before we get into that, let's talk about our ephemera. Basically, this is extra textual stuff that will help you appreciate the episode more. And I just wanted to bring up for this one. Tosin mentioned earlier when we talked about the title Phase Space that it was the title of a 2003 science fiction collection by British writer Stephen Baxter. So that is what we're going to link in our ephemera, our reading list this week. I don't think we have anything else for that section. So
I think that's it. But you just made me realize something. Bernard and Elsie,
yeah,
are in the cradle, and Maeve and her team are in the graves.
From the cradle.
I was thinking about that.
To the graves. Oh, snap.
God.
Oh, snap. Oh, snap.
I just didn't want to say it.
Oh, nice pull. Nice. See, we pay attention to shit here on Violet Delights, man.
have you guys ever seen the film Cloud Atlas?
Loved
never.
It. Loved it. It's interesting. The book is amazing. The movie is a little bit of it's a valiant attempt, but it sort of fails a little bit in execution, but it's still fascinating to watch. I will always give the Wachowskis the benefit of a doubt, because they swing for the fences every time, and I'd rather see an ambitious failure than a mediocre success.
See, that's really interesting because so I'm a big fan of David Mitchell, the author of Cloud Atlas.
Yeah.
He also wrote the Bone Clocks, which won like the Man Prize, some incredibly hard, difficult prize to get for writing English literature. So the book, cool. Now I give the Wachowskis the opposite of the benefit of the doubt.
Mm.
I think they got lucky with The Matrix. I think they did a good job with the film. Ouch. Before that. But when I look at the subsequent stuff, I see things that are not finished, disappointing. I can even see Sense8. So if it says Wachowski's on it, I have to have a lot of friends say that they thought it was absolutely stunning and awesome for me to actually like pick it up.
Ouch.
But Tosin, Cloud Atlas, how do you link that to Westworld?
So the reason why I just kind of brought it up at service this last minute is just it's very interesting when we talk about like phase space. And if you recall in Cloud Atlas, it has like Tom Hanks and several other people jumping into playing different characters in sort of different worlds.
Oh, interesting.
Different versions of themselves. Together. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I just found that might be an interesting way of looking at that concept on a different stage.
Interesting. I'm gonna link that in our reading list.
Yeah, and I mean, if you're gonna do that, then you should definitely check out David Mitchell's other book because he plays with these themes a lot. The Bone Clocks, again, won big awards, and it's about moving through space, phasing through space, almost literally. Not only that, but it does go through the whole multiple life thing, which he, I think he likes to play with.
No spoilers. So, I haven't read Bone Clocks yet.
Yeah, you should check that out. And I think it does tie to Westworld because some of the people in that story do have chances, the way the hosts have chances to live multiple lives, multiple roles, or like even relive the same thing over again. There's an element of that that is super significant in the Bone Clocks. It's a long burn of a book, and it ends just like wow, right? Your leg is bouncing as you read it, so it's great.
Nice. All right, speaking of spoilers, here we come to our spoiler section. So abandon all hope, ye who enter here. So unless you want to be spoiled for the next episode or fan theories, then turn away here, turn off the podcast, skip forward to the very end, whatever, you know, we'll see you next week. But otherwise, if you want to be spoiled, here we go. So let's talk about what the preview for next week's episode. I saw this preview and immediately afterwards I'm like, oh shit. It's like this is going to be the shit hits the fan episode, apparently. There's so much going on in there. So it starts off with Maeve saying you're lost in the dark. And you see that over the image of Maeve hiding in the homestead house as a rider rides by outside. And then Dolores's voiceover says, when you've been in the darkness long enough, you begin to see. You made us in your image, created us to look like you, think like you, bleed like you. Did you really think I'd let that continue? And over that, we see a bunch of images. We see Hale, Stubbs, and the QA team entering a storehouse full of Bernard host bodies, a multiplicity of Bernard host bodies. We see a bloodstained Teddy dressed as a QA member, and he's brandishing a modern QA rifle. We see the man in black raising his head in anguish. I'm not sure what that is. We see Dolores and her horde walking towards camera in the flaming ruins of the Mesa. I guess we can assume that is after the train crashes into the Mesa tunnel. We see, and then we see Robert Ford speaking to Bernard, saying what is about to happen will not be your fault. And then we hear Bernard go no, and then we see a piece of music which happens to be the Beethoven's Seventh Symphony, specifically the second movement, and over that we see the QA team in the map room fighting Dolores's horde, what appears to be Dolores's horde. We see Angela, and she appears to be dressed in modern clothes, and she's facing an armed QA member, and he's looking at her like lustily. We see Zombie Clem, and she's in the body shop shooting a rifle at something. It's hard to tell what it is. It's obscured.
It's like an automatic rifle too, right?
Yeah. Automatic rifle, like fast rounds. It's obscured by the blood on the glass walls in the body shop, so it's not clear what she's shooting at. We see Sizemore hiding behind something. We see Maeve in the...
always see Sizemore.
Yeah, I think that's every episode. Sizemore is hiding behind something. We see Maeve shouting no. And then we see Dolores standing next to Peter Abernathy, still crucified on the table. And she is firing at something in front of her. We get a quick shot of Bernard firing a QA rifle, a modern QA rifle. And then we hear a female voice saying, open your eyes. And then Bernard opens his eyes and we can see the reflection of somebody through the pupil of his eyes. It's not easy to tell who that is.
Let's talk about darkness for a second.
Yeah.
Akane foreshadows in this episode when she says, "We must hurry before the darkness eats us alive." Then we see all these references you just mentioned to it in the trailer. I'm thinking the darkness, that place Glory they kept on talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
I'd like to see some of those places come to fruition. What do they mean by the darkness? Is the darkness the Mesa because it's dark? I mean, it's literally dark, right? Or do they mean something more figurative, more existential? And then where is Glory? You know, they were all trying to head toward Glory two episodes ago, and now that seems like it's another thread in the wind. I'd like to see that pulled back. But I do like the foreshadowing of Akane. It just adds more to the validity of the Shogun World stuff, so that's helpful too.
Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I love that quote, "Before the darkness eats us alive." It's just so much impending doom, so much dread coming at us.
I'd like to see a main character die soon. Just, I like tragedy. It's what I like.
Yeah. Well, maybe we'll get one per season. We had Teresa in last season. So
Teresa
maybe
and Ford, sort of.
Ford, more or less, kind of, sort of. All right, let's get into some fan theories here. Some really interesting things this came up this episode. I think things that will play out in future episodes, I believe. First of all, we talked about how the showrunners are sort of laying these little clues here and there early on in the season, or early on in the series, like in first season even, that sort of will be paying off in future seasons as they know how the arc of the series pays out. So there was a bit of a conversation in season one, episode one, in the very first episode, that when I heard it, it felt to me like a little bit of a Chekhov's gun. It was that conversation that Dolores had with Teddy about the Judas steer, who leads all of the other steer to their death, right? To the slaughterhouse. And when that conversation came up, I'm like, this is going to be important, but it never came up again in season one. So my guess is that Teddy is that figurative Judas steer, that he's going to be the one to lead other hosts to the death that we see at the beginning of season two, which is all of the hosts in the submerged valley drowned.
You don't think that's Dolores?
I don't know. I think it's going to be Teddy. Is my guess.
So she's opened up Pandora's box by awakening Teddy.
I think so. I think, and he's going to maybe her purpose for him is for him to be the Judas deer. Another fan theory that this is my own sort of headcanon theory. In this episode, Bernard says to Elsie, "I believe if anyone can right the ship by force of sheer will, it's you." And to me, I saw that as a big red flag also. That feels like very much like foreshadowing. Like maybe Elsie, in this entire situation, Elsie will be the one to sort of save the whole situation.
I'm hoping Elsie isn't the one that dies, because he's like, whatever happens, it's not your fault. And then Elsie ends up like with her neck broken or something.
I don't think so, and I'll tell you why. Because we've already seen her almost die. We saw her and presumed that she was dead at the end of season one, and I don't think that they'd pull that off twice in a row. I think she's going to be the hero of all this, and I think Bernard is basically flagging the audience, foreshadowing it right there in that scene. And this last fan theory comes from the internet, and I thought this was really interesting because when I saw this, it like pinged for me while I was watching the episode, because I usually watch the episodes of Westworld with the closed captioning on, and when they were in the cradle and Elsie is talking about how she can't get into the computer, over her dialogue, the closed caption said that it was Hale. It listed the dialogue as coming from Hale. Could have been a mistake, you know, could have been a typo, but they actually do it twice over two bits of Elsie's dialogue.
So the idea that Elsie is just a figment of his imagination, and in fact, it's Hale?
Well, here's the thing that sort of backs up that theory, is that when Bernard was losing cortical fluid. And they were reading off sort of like symptoms of the loss of cortical fluid, what that could do to a host. One of the symptoms is prosopagnosia, or face blindness. So the inability to recognize familiar faces in front of you, or the confusing faces that you think you know for other people.
Oh, so Elsie is way dead, and it's been Hale the whole time.
Or maybe not that Elsie is way dead, but maybe...
Oh, she's dead, man. She's dead. She's in that same cave. She didn't have enough food. She's just a skeleton. Dead.
Or maybe Bernard brought Hale to the cradle in believing that it was Elsie. You know, who knows? I don't know. These are all questions, but I guarantee you that I get a strong feeling that this last one may come into play for sure.
The only thing that I don't understand about that is Hale seems to be technologically not there. Right? She doesn't know how to use the technology. So the idea that Elsie is able to say, oh, they kept the, I'm on the diagnostics. It looks like they kept the climate control going. And or things like, I can't even turn off your pain. I can't do this. You know, but she's in the system anyway. Hale can't get in the system like that. Like, I mean, I guess I could look back, but I don't really see Hale. Hale's asking Bernard to get in the system. She's not a tech. She's a suit, right? That kind of thing. She doesn't understand like that kind of stuff. So if it is that, I'm going to be a little mad at these things. It's going to have to be explained away as Bernard rationalizing the behavior or something.
Sure. Well, we already know Bernard's pretty much confused. He is a unreliable narrator.
He's through the looking glass. He doesn't know what the fuck is going on.
Long episode tonight, but I think that is going to do it for this week's episode of Violent Delights. With the exception of going around the table here, I'm going to start with you, Dwayne. Where can people find your work on the internet when you're not here on Violent Delights?
Check me out on Twitter, twitter.com/DwayneD, where I talk about tech. Also check me out on Geeks of Doom. You can find me hanging out with these guys. Andy, I'll tell you about that later. Tosin, where can we find you?
You can find me at twitter.com/toast4321, and you can also find me at Geeks of Doom as well. What about yourself, Andy?
You can find me at MrBabyMan.com. That is my social media handle, Mr. Babyman. Or you can also just do a Google search for Mr. Babyman or Andrew Sorsini, and you'll find everything I'm liking and linking throughout the week there. Along with these two fine gentlemen, we do two other podcasts. We do The Dominant Paradigm, which is our podcast following Starz, American Gods, which is currently in production, will be on air fairly soon. We do a weekly tech podcast called The Drill Down. I highly recommend you guys subscribe to that if you like our analysis. And those are the other two that we do. Okay, so that is going to do it for this week. So join us on next week's episode of Violent Delights, where we cover episode 7 of Westworld second season. And that episode is titled Les Écorches, which is French for the skinned, which already sounds fairly gruesome. I don't know what the significance of that is, but I guess we'll find out.
I like French things.
Everything changed when the ghost mission attacked.
Thanks, guys. We'll see you next week on Violent Delights.
Thanks for listening. Bye.